Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB. 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Good morning. Now today we're talking about the nation's most notorious wrongful conviction, and that is of Stephen Avery. Now he's a Wisconsin man who spent 18 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. So with us today is the author of the book, The Innocent Killer, Michael Griesbach. Now, he's also the district attorney in the same county that Stephen Avery was convicted. And, of course, he's the next generation. And welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm glad to be here, Al. Absolutely.
So, in all the controversy, and I know we've talked before, and I see a lot of the feedback we get. I guess you've been put in kind of a awkward position. So I wanted to do this follow-up because as I read the book, we interviewed last May, I sort of saw it as you were writing the book to talk about the wrongful conviction suit and about the whole justice system and kind of what was happening with... you know, it's the innocent man kind of thing. And I think that we kind of need it to bring that out because of the feedback I've been getting.
Sure.
Okay.
That's exactly right. I never dreamed that this would become a contentious thing, at least from that side of the equation, the people who think that, you know, that I'm somehow an anti-Stephen Avery pro-law enforcement type. If anything, when I wrote the book, I was more concerned about how my colleagues in law enforcement, especially district attorneys, would view me and my book, because I was, you know, going against the grain. I was taking to task my predecessors, former, you know, law enforcement, former sheriff, former DA in a case, and not just saying, look, this was a wrongful conviction back in 1985. This is a horrible wrongful conviction. This was a, you know, essentially an intentional or reckless sending away an innocent person for 18 years. And yes, I think the focus, in fact, two-thirds of my book was about that. Only the last third touched on Teresa Halbach's murder. And I did try to bring in the lessons of the criminal justice system. I spoke about wrongful convictions, spoke about prosecutor misconduct. But here we are, you know.
Yeah.
what a difference television makes.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's sort of how I took it. I mean, that was last year. And when I finished and went on and, you know, months are going by, to me, the book left me thinking more about his wrongful conviction and about what happened and about not so much about Teresa Halbach, which I guess that's, you know, bad in a way, but that it wasn't intentional. But for me, the main focus was the 18 years and what the sort of how the prosecution system worked in this case. So how has it been with the work still working in the same county and with the other with the sheriffs and people? I guess they've moved on, of course, but is it okay now?
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, I was surprised to some extent. I mean, not completely surprised, but the police, for instance, especially the Manitowoc City Police Department, different officers in court would say, you know, thanks a lot for writing that book and explaining what the police, the sheriff, a handful of police in the Manitowoc County Sheriff's Department, a different agency, and the former district attorney did, because they appreciate when, you know, people, your listeners won't believe this, but most police, you know, actually want the bad apples to be out there. They wanted them, they want them to be held accountable, because like any profession, you know, there's some bad apples among police and among prosecutors, but I do think the vast majority of them would never do anything like happened in the first Avery case. They're interested in trying to do their best to seek justice in a tough system. That's not to say that, you know, there isn't a special authority, especially with police, that unchecked authority when they're out on the streets. Especially that used to be a bigger problem and still is. Although I think cameras, body cameras, have really helped that a lot. So maybe there's a greater danger, I think there is, frankly, of what the bad apples can do in these positions. Same with prosecutors. We're given probably way too much power and discretion in the court system. But the bottom line is most police are not interested in doing that sort of thing. They are decent people. They're people's husbands and fathers who, right now, not a real easy job, frankly, and kind of a dangerous job. And that I wrote the book, they appreciated it. Now, I'll be honest, the prosecutors have been a little bit standoffish. Not so much in my office. I'm friends with them, you know, but prosecutors throughout the state. With the exception of just a few, it's my book's been met with kind of a cold silence. I don't know that they liked that I took, you know, suggesting that a former prosecutor essentially intentionally, or recklessly at the least, sent an innocent guy away to prison. We can be an arrogant lot. I'll confess that right here. It's an occupational hazard. And call a prosecutor on a mistake and say, you did this and you shouldn't have done that. If you want to watch somebody get real defensive real quick, that's the way you do it.
Oh, yeah. You see that every day. You just want to watch Nancy Grace. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's a...
There you go.
Then I don't mean it badly. I guess it, well, you know, it just comes across that way. But you actually took this further, like you took the evidence and took it to Madison and tried to get something done with your predecessor. So it wasn't like you just let it happen.
Right. No, we got really troubled, myself and another DA, by what they did. And we did. We took it to the Wisconsin State Attorney General's office for an independent review. And she whitewashed the entire affair, and that's what I wrote in the book. I mean, that's the top Wisconsin law enforcement official at the time. That's not the AG now, but that was the Attorney General back in 2003 when we took it there. And she basically blamed it on, you know, tunnel vision or something and found no criminal or ethical misconduct upon the part of the former sheriff and former DA, which frankly is nonsense in my view.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and we were talking about that. So what do you think the negative backlash is all about? Is that just about from the Making the Murderer and how they portrayed everything?
Well, I think that's a good chunk of it. I mean, Making a Murderer came in the context of a strong feeling throughout the country that, you know, I'm not saying anything you and the your listeners aren't fully aware of, but a strong distrust of police, especially in urban areas with the police shootings that are very troubling, some of the racial stuff that is very troubling. There's a slew of recent cases, appellate court cases, and especially in California, and in New York, and accompanied by media attention, New York Times opinions on prosecutor misconduct and prosecutor arrogance and prosecutor's failure to disclose what we call exculpatory evidence, which is evidence that could help a defendant suggest maybe an innocent, maybe the defendant, you know, maybe he didn't do it, or at least could help him suggest that he didn't do it. Sometimes there's been too many instances where there's been failures to turn that stuff over, and then the reaction by the prosecutors in these cases, U.S. attorneys' offices, sometimes the worst, has been, oh, you know, no big deal, we harmless error, we didn't mean to do that, sorry, we won't do it again. You know, so that's the context of when this comes in. So I get it as to why people are upset. You know, there is, though, in addition to that, that's just the context that this all comes to play. Making a Murderer itself, while it did some good things by bringing, you know, attention to the criminal justice system, to a wide group of people usually wouldn't care that much, it also did a huge disservice, in my opinion, by presenting a one-sided sort of agenda-driven version of what happened in this particular case in the county where I work still as an assistant district attorney.
Yeah. And so, well, I think the most shocking was probably about the Brendan Dassey, the interviews that he had without proper counsel, and if anything, they set him up. But that's not illegal, is it? That's a legal way of interviewing.
It is to a point. They call it the Reed technique, R-E-I-D, from some former cop or a psychologist or something in northern Illinois, used all across the country. And that is troubling. My family and I watched the movie, the Netflix documentary together, and we were troubled by it. I had kind of heard portions of it, but I didn't realize just how aggressive the interrogation was of Brendan Dassey, who, you know, is obviously, you know, emotionally or at least intellectually has some shortcomings. And, you know, some people would argue he's got, you know, the equivalent of maybe a sixth grader in terms of recognizing what might happen after this. You know, what will happen tomorrow if this happens today? I don't think that was there with him. So, yeah, I completely, in fact, I very much separate out Brendan Dassey's case from Stephen Avery's case as much as you can, because they get interrelated eventually. But the court's going to have to take a good look at that. That case is in federal court in Milwaukee, so I can't, you know, comment too much on it. But I can say that they need to really wrestle with that, and I'm sure they will, and figure out whether it crossed the line legally. There are a lot of people who think, and I don't know that I disagree, that the courts right now are allowing too much of that kind of interrogation by police, where the goal is to break the person down and have them confess to a crime that the police are convinced the person did, as opposed to finding out the truth, you know. So the two police officers, unfortunately, are, you know, they're reaping the threats and the anger from people's reactions against that technique. They were following a technique that's allowed, which So, you know, let's talk more about the system, I guess. I was hoping, or do hope, eventually, instead of threatening police officers who weren't really violating the law as it stood or as it stands, and we'll see where that law goes.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think they're, one of the biggest feedbacks we got was about how they could take him in there and interview him for hours at a time, and he had no parent with him or no one of age, no counsel with him. And I think that was the biggest, like, how could that stand in court? How could they use that evidence when he had no adult with him?
Here's where it gets really fact-specific, Al. Apparently his mother chose not to be there in the first interview. And his mother, and this isn't the one shown, this isn't the one at the Sheriff's Department. This, remember, there were like three or four interviews, hours of interviews, and Making a Murderer only showed one of them that wasn't used in trial. As far as his lawyer not being there, that is like malpractice per se, should be, you know, it's ridiculous. I don't think that was the confession that was used either. So some of the premises of that people are upset about are not true. I'm not trying to say that even what they used in trial should be the way that the law allows it. I mean, you could make an argument that any juvenile should always be required to have the parent there. What if the parent says no, though? And even if the parent doesn't say no, the law, at least in Wisconsin, is the juvenile doesn't have to be there. There'd be a lot of shootings and armed robberies that would go unsolved or unprosecuted, with even dead people, murders, you know, if that was the absolute question, or the law, a prohibition against that. So these are balancing things that have to be balanced and weighed out. His case, whether this crossed the line, is open to interpretation. I guess what the court will look at, though, is not just what all the viewers looked at of Making a Murderer. The court will look at which particular interview was introduced into evidence, not the really shaky, dicey ones that you know, he was not served with effective assistance of counsel. In fact, he was sabotaged, probably well-intended by his counsel and the counsel's private investigator. But there was an interview before that that the court will have to try to figure out if it was coercive or not. If it was coercive, it gets suppressed, and he gets a new trial. And I would think there's nothing, you know, there with which to use as evidence against Brenda Dassey. So, you know, it might be that his time in prison is done. And it is what the law is. Whatever the case law and the court finds in rules of evidence and what is presented for it, not a documentary and not the anger that's expressed. But the court might conclude that, you know, I mean, the court has to figure this out, and we'll see what the court does.
So. Yeah, it certainly drew the line. I will say that about the documentary, in the fact that they sort of laid out the good guy and the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of feel that, if anything, from the beginning. And those guys that interviewed Dassey were made to look bad straight across the board. There was no, it wasn't a two-sided, you know, it didn't give them any opportunity.
No, and you know, it does look bad. And a police officer interrogating, and sometimes it is bad. You know, there's some officers that do it in a fairer way. Now, I'm not going to weigh in on what Wiegert and, Fassbender did here. But I can say that what they showed, I'm sure, is the worst of what those two cops did. But, you know, I don't want to totally sit here and justify. I've had some cops that their interviewing techniques I can't stand, and I don't use it. and I wish they weren't police officers. I don't think Wiegert and Fassbender are in that club. I don't work with them. They're different jurisdictions. But I've seen worse. How's that? And recognizing this, please, listeners, you did not see the whole thing. You saw the worst parts of the interview. But I'd like to talk about Avery, and I know we're getting there, because Dassey, I don't disagree necessarily with a lot of the viewers of Making a Murderers, certainly the troubling aspects of it and that they're troubled by it. We'll just see what the justice system, which, you know, if we get to the point where we don't trust at all the justice system, courts and the appellate process and rules of evidence and constitutional principles that have been around since, whatever, 1600s in England, and that us, you know, as a democracy, accept it. It's not perfect, but if we assume it's all corrupt and that that Making a Murderer and documentaries like this are all right, correct, you can't look further, or you got to accept that version and not trust the courts whatsoever at every level, we're in trouble in the criminal justice system.
Yeah. Well, I have one other major comment that I had on Dassey, and we get into Avery. It was about the when they showed him being asked who shot her, and a lot of people commented that that was leading, that was giving him the answer, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that an okay in a trial or in an interview for a trial?
My understanding, Al, and I focused on the first Avery case, so I put that caveat in there that I am not an absolute expert on the second one. I'm learning and I'm reading. I've already read the transcripts, but I am not privy to every single bit. But and I can't, you know, I'm flying through transcripts, tell you the truth. It's hard to take it all in. But my understanding is actually Brendan had said something about a gun and shooting Ms. Halbach, Mr. Avery shooting Ms. Halbach before that interview, in an interview that I think was used in the trial and was not shown on Making a Murderer. Now, let's fact check that. I'll fact check it when I'm done. And I'm sure your listeners will fact check it. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But I truly am almost certain, at least that's what a person that I know, non-law enforcement officer, reminded me of the other day. And if that person's wrong, I will be talking to that person. But I think he had stated in a prior interview that is not shown in Making a Murderer, that I think was also said in court, that Stephen Avery told the police Stephen Avery had shot Teresa Halbach. I don't know if he said in the head, I don't know, but I believe there was mention of a gun and a shooting. I do want to put that in as a I believe so as I couched it. I'm not certain of that.
Yeah, you don't want to be certain.
yeah.
They'll check. Back in the Steve Avery case then, what were the things that bothered you the most about the prosecution?
The prosecution of the old Steve Avery case or the new one?
Well,
the original one?
Yeah, the original one.
In 1985?
Yeah.
Yeah, lots. Number one, the prosecutor lied to his staff. His staff came up and said, hey, I think it's Gregory Allen. It looks like him more. He sounds like him. And the prosecutor at the time in 1985 said, no, I checked, and the sheriff checked. Allen, Gregory Allen, the real assailant, was on probation. He's on probation still. His agent told me he's got an airtight alibi. It can't be Allen. Well, attorney generals found that actually Allen wasn't even on probation. There's a number of other things, including a complaint I found in the Avery file showing that the same prosecutor, who I name in the book, you know, Dennis Vogel, had prosecuted the real assailant, Gregory Allen, back in 1985 for attacking a woman or trying to attack a woman, lunging at her, dropping his shorts on the same section of beach that Penny Burnson was attacked 2 years later by Mr. Allen. There was other evidence. I believe a leather jacket lineup was sort of faked. I believe some police witnesses probably perjured themselves about seeing Mr. Avery wearing a leather jacket at various occasions when they had contact with him in the few prior years because Penny had described a very particular leather jacket on her assailant. I think the sheriff knew, and the DA knew, very likely, within a couple days that Avery didn't do it. And there's other evidence for that, too, that gets pretty densely packed in here we don't have time for. And they knew Gregory Allen did it, which is just as bad, or worse. I don't know which. They're both bad. And they kept going against Mr. Avery, sent him away for 18 years for a crime he didn't do, and let Mr. Allen go free. And Allen brutally raped a woman in Green Bay 8 years after escaping responsibility for attacking and almost killing Penny Burnson. So those guys remain unaccounted both for all this, the two, the sheriff and the DA. They dodged a bullet on a wrongful conviction lawsuit when they were personally sued. They got a pass from the Wisconsin Attorney General when she found no criminal ethical violations, and they're still not getting any heat. It's the current officers who weren't even there at the time and who, you know, who were involved in this case because of an investigation that happened on their watch, but they're paying essentially for the, you know, the sins of their predecessors, and their predecessors are skating free. It's troubling in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Well, I think that from what you can see on the documentary, it looks like it's because some of the cops there that found the evidence in the new case are kind of blamed for planting the evidence, and a lot of people just are convinced of that, period, that they happen to be the same ones being deposed in the first one for the lawsuit, happened to find the evidence in the second case. And I think that that's probably why, because they consider them. Are they still working on the force right now?
One of them is retired and did retire probably 5 years ago, Jim Link. Right. The other, Andy Colburn, is still a detective or a lieutenant at the Sheriff's Department. But worth noting, though, Al, is that neither of them were here in 1985 when Mr. Avery was wrongly convicted the first time. And second of all, they were not sued. They were not parties in the wrongful conviction lawsuit. They were witnesses. They received a call, and that's why they were being deposed. I think Colburn was just a corrections officer at the time, and Link was probably a deputy at the time. In 1995, 10 years after Avery was wrongly convicted, they get this call from Green Bay PD saying, and this is at night, you know, second or third shift, something, saying, hey, there's this inmate we have who's saying he did this crime, and you got the wrong guy in prison for it. He kind of referenced the crime on the beach. So my guess is they didn't even know, Colburn Link didn't even know it was the Burnson case, the Avery case, because I don't think they used the name. But they did what they should, frankly. They passed it up the line to the higher-ups. And the higher-ups said, nope, tell them, we don't want to hear it. We got our guy. We don't know what they're talking about. So, you know, Colburn and Link had no reason to believe that Avery, that this guy who was in prison before they were even there, was wrongly convicted, and they were doing what the higher up, probably the sheriff himself, who has escaped responsibility for this, told them to do. So, but the timing is horrible. I think it's 3 or 4 weeks after their deposition that Teresa disappeared and was murdered, and they shouldn't have been in the trailer. I mean, let's face it, they did not belong in the trailer. that is presented a bit worse in the documentary than it really was. There was a Calumet County cop with him the entire time. The documentary only shows the, you know, kind of that final question by the defense where the Calumet County cop ends up admitting, you know, I guess it's possible, you know, they could have, or if I looked away, maybe they could have planted a key. And, of course, the documentary shows an empty bookcase with the key on the floor. The fact is, the bookcase was...
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Not empty when they pulled it away. They pulled away a full jam with magazines and books things. They were looking through that, those things for evidence, for stuff that I'm not able to really explain. Well, pornography, essentially, that they thought maybe would be relevant if depending on what they found to the trial. And this is weeks after the murder, and in jamming the stuff back, and this is in the testimony, I believe, jamming the stuff back, the fake backing of this thing, or the cheap backing, kind of pulled away and the key dropped out. So what is Making a Murder show? They show an empty bookcase with the key on the ground as if nobody could have missed that earlier. Totally, completely manipulates the viewer.
What were they doing there anyway? If I thought you guys in your county were called off, and I think that's one of the big, you know, feedback issues I have here is why were they allowed to go there and investigate, even if there was another cop there?
Right. They shouldn't have been. I mean, the district attorney's office, myself and my boss, we were there, my new boss, because I helped a lot. He was brand new. Were called to the scene when it was still a missing person, when her car was first found. And I was there for several hours until the remains of Teresa, the dog, hit on those remains. Then it became a homicide, an official homicide case. I mean, everybody suspected we'd probably find Teresa's remains there, but there was no guarantee of that. So, but at that point, when we know it's a homicide, and let's face it, Avery, the police might have denied it, but he was the main suspect. I mean, he called her out there, so let's call apples apples and oranges oranges here. But he wasn't the only suspect, by the way. They got the DNA from all the other Averys, too. But he was the main suspect, and as soon as Teresa's remains were found, myself and the DA backed off and left. I left. I don't know if he left immediately. The police are under themselves, the Sheriff's Department. They thought that with the size of the Calumet County force, which is, you know, probably a fourth of the size of Manitowoc, boy, it'd be kind of tough for them to search that whole property. So the sheriff or whoever decided that they'd sort of compromise, and you can't. You either have a conflict or you're not. You're either pregnant or you're not, is the simile or the metaphor that lawyers use. But they decided as long as another jurisdiction police officer is with Manitowoc County officers as they search. That's what we're going to do, and that'll provide any kind of assurance that Manitowoc is not planting evidence, and they shouldn't have. Or if they did, they should never have had any Manitowoc County cop searching around the actual residence and in the residence. Outbuildings, maybe, or the cars, the thousands of cars, or wherever, you know, that's where they should have focused. But they didn't, and here we are.
Yeah, yeah, it was a mistake. And mm-hmm. One other thing is how they could actually tried the cases separately, and one of the other big questions was how can they have tried them differently. And I think what they're trying to say is on Dassey they went with his story and confession of raping her in the room, stabbing, shooting, the whole thing, the shop and all that, and how they could say that there was no blood and try him on that. And then on Stephen Avery, they didn't even bring it up, and they didn't have him, Dassey, for the trial.
Right, exactly. And I understand that. I've read that in various places, too. And for the person who doesn't do, you know, law and criminal law and litigation and trials, I get why they think that. The fact is, the prosecution could not mention anything about Dassey and how about Dassey's statement as to how the murder happened. That would be a mistrial because Brendan Dassey never cut a deal with the state. Therefore, he has Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate himself. And the state could not use him or his testimony in the Avery case. So the way it works, and it puts us in a weird position sometimes as prosecutors and defense lawyers too, you have to only argue what the evidence, the actual evidence admitted into court, that's allowed into court. So the state on the Avery case could not say anything about how Teresa died. They couldn't say anything about the knifing and the shooting and the bedroom and the torture, etc. All they could talk about was the physical evidence found and the circumstances of Stephen Avery having called out specifically to get Teresa there, asking specifically that she be the one that come to his residence, the junkyard, to take the pictures. And I think he hid his identity, at least that's what's argued by the state on the Star 67 thing. So it was a circumstantial case and a physical evidence case in the case of Avery. Brendan Dassey's case is the exact opposite. There was no physical evidence tying Brendan Dassey to it, if I recall correctly. It was all his own statement. And, you know, there have been false confession cases where, the person confessed, but counterintuitively they confessed to something they didn't do. Proven cases where, you know, they sat in prison. And did that happen in Brendan Dassey's case? Some people think it did. I don't know. I don't believe it did. I've looked at all four hours of the videotape confession. If I just watched Making a Murder, I think I'd walk away like a lot of the viewers, the majority of viewers did. Again, that's for a court to decide. Brendan Dassey, you know, he has a right, an absolute right, and this time to effective counsel, arguing that the confession was coerced out of him, and secondarily, maybe in addition to being coerced, it was false. Although even if it's a true confession, if it was coerced under the law against his constitutional rights, he deserves a new trial. And frankly, release probably, because there is no other evidence that I'm aware of anyhow. But enough on Brendan Dassey. It's pending. I just think it's important that he get his day in court and right. Mr. Avery get his day in court, too. But let's let it be court and real evidence and all the evidence. So that's what I think, anyhow.
Yeah, and being a prosecutor, you must deal with things like the blood, for instance. Like, so when they went back and found Stephen Avery's blood sample from the first, and it had the hole in the top, and I guess apparently it wasn't sealed correctly. Now, is that realistic? Is that common, or is that something that should be suspicious?
My understanding is it's very common that you know, when you draw blood in a forensic sense, in a criminal case at least, and you're preserving the blood in a test tube to send it to a hygiene lab or a crime lab to test it, what you do is you draw the blood from the person through a tube into the test tube, through a plastic tube, that is, into the main the test tube, the vial, blood vial itself, and you do it through a needle that goes through the stopper or the cap of it. So you actually expect that. Again, making a murder makes it seem like it's, you know, shocking discovery. And they don't explain the rest, which which the defense knew at the time. The seal, I don't know enough about it. I suspect that the seal, you know, that blood had been tested a lot and opened a lot because of the appeals on Avery's case. I think once again there's been a misrepresentation about what the blood vial in that condition means.
Was there anything about the second case in the show that, you know, making a murder, that you, and about the evidence and about what they're saying as, you know, it's all tampered, or was there any evidence that you thought was a little suspicious, or do you sort of think that it's all reasonable?
Look, the key bothered me. It just looks too strange. But in looking through it further, you know, it had been eight years since any of us had followed this case. I wasn't the prosecutor. I hope people remember that. I am from the area, and I didn't have time to watch the entire trial. You know, I have a caseload of heroin and all kinds of things that we deal with. Domestic abuse, drunk driving. It's Wisconsin, after all, so there's a lot of drunk driving. Robberies, et cetera, burglaries. Yeah. So I didn't watch it all, but I knew enough about it at the time. I especially knew a lot about Brendan Dassey's confession, and perhaps that's why I was so certain in my first book, The Innocent Killer, of Avery's guilt. I nobody really questioned it. I still don't question it, because now I know a lot more. And I've looked into it more, but on first watch, if you watch just what they had before you, you start to wonder, you know, how did those guys end up there, and boy, that looks fishy. You got to look further, that's all I'm saying, and that's up to your listeners. I don't, from my Facebook page and other things that are going on with me, including threats and ugly things, I suspect, well, I know that a certain amount of your listeners who feel strongest about this won't listen to anything I say, and, you know, that's their right. It's too bad, and I don't think it's the way to approach trying to find the truth. But if people are really interested in the truth, they'll keep the personal stuff out. You know, maybe I come off as too all-knowing or something, and if I do, I'm sorry, but I'm speaking as a flawed human being like everybody else. But let's have a little respect, at least, I hope, from the other people, and not assume everything without looking further into it.
Oh, for sure, yeah, and it's not acceptable. They shouldn't be threatening or doing anything like that. I think there's just a lot of emotion going on in the country, and this just sort of is another one of those triggers.
I think you're right, Al. Most people don't, you know, approach it that way, but there's a sizable, very vocal group that does, and some of it has gotten out of hand. There were bomb threats at our sheriff at the jail the other day. You know, we're going to get the sheriff's department and the district attorneys office, which is right next, you know, the courthouse is, whatever, 50 feet away. You know, Colburn gets a call on Christmas Day from trying to celebrate with his family at home, you know, threatening his wife. A couple cops, you know, threatened on the job. People yelling Avery, you know, and punched at or at least swung at, and I'm going to kill you and your family. And worse, I'm not even scratching the surface of this. So it's gotten a little out of hand. So, and I do get the passion and the emotion, and part of this is fueled, most of it's fueled, by a really interesting show, a great, you know, draw-you-in kind of documentary or show, I think. Personally, I think it's a little more accurate, but well done, to be sure, and probably well-intended for the most part. You know, the criminal justice system is pretty screwed up in a lot of ways, so raising these issues, including the issue of, you know, it's hard for people less blessed in life economically and, you know, social economic classes to get a fair shake in the criminal justice system. I covered that in my first book. Extremely much, excessively so. Well, not excessively, but a lot. And the confession interrogation technique stuff, those are all legitimate questions, important questions. And so are the other ones. You know, was he wrongly convicted a second time? But my only point, and I don't think I'm being all-knowing, is they didn't have the whole thing. They had a one-sided portrayal. You don't put on Stephen Avery's prior cat-burning incident when he, and this is when he was 22, not younger, as they kind of imply. You don't suggest that that was just sort of an accident horsing around with friends and the cat, he was throwing it up and it ended up in the fire. You don't do that when, in fact, when he was 22, he doused the cat with gasoline and intentionally threw it in the fire. And the cat died, and he pled to animal cruelty. Or the incident with the ramming the woman in the car with his pickup truck and then holding her at gunpoint after she lost control of the car. You don't portray that as just, oh, he's getting back at her because she was spreading rumors about him and his family. And she probably was. You know, that's typical. But in fact, he had been watching her for months with a pair of binoculars, essentially stalking her, watching her get into her car from up the street in the morning early, driving by. Occasionally he would, often he would sexually gratify himself as she drove by. One time he even, or more than once, ran into the car, into the highway right before her, nude. And then he only let her go after he held a rifle to her head. When she pointed out she had an infant in the back seat of the car. And the infant would freeze to death. And Stephen let her go at that point. He pled to that offense, by the way, not a sex offense, because he did let her go. He didn't assault her. But he recklessly endangered her safety. I mean, you ram your pickup truck into a woman's car and hold a rifle at gunpoint, rifle up to her head. You know, that's pretty criminal stuff. That's not just getting back at somebody for spreading false rumors. He pled to that and did 6 of his 18 years he would have done anyhow because of those 6 years in prison. So it just isn't good when you portray something as truth and balance that isn't balanced. Yeah. It just causes all kinds of problems.
Yeah, I will say, but when I was watching it, and the first part where they kind of talked about that, I the first couple of episodes, I wasn't really a fan of Steve Avery. I kind of thought, he's not really that great of a guy. So it didn't really turn me to thinking, oh, I like him. And
but Al, did you have any idea, like on those 2 instances, or did you have any idea that he was as dangerous or as serious? I mean, those are pretty serious things. You know, pouring gas on a cat's fire, on a cat, and then throwing it in a fire, and also ramming a pickup truck into a woman, you know, and watching her with binoculars. They're pretty careful not to do any of the sexual stuff. You know, they never mention anything about scouting her with binoculars. No. And, you know, disrobing himself and running in the street in front of her and masturbating as she drive by outside on his pickup truck. Had they said that, it makes it too close to what later happened to Teresa Halbach. Not the exact thing, but it those issues, that sexual slash violence that kind of accompanies those things. You didn't like them, but I don't think, and maybe I watched it wrong, but I don't think many viewers got the impression that this guy had those kind of problems from anywhere.
No, they definitely edited that in the sense of, because I did think that he just threw the cat on horsing around with friends, drinking. That was kind of my idea. And I also had the feeling that with the girl, he was threatening her because she was telling stories. I didn't really get the idea of the sexual content and stuff like that. So that's true. Yeah. So that.
Yeah, they almost made him like the victim on the ramming his pickup, you know, because she was not a nice person. She was, you know, did not like him and was, could have been spreading. I have no idea. But that's what they portrayed the whole thing as, that, well, it's okay. He didn't know how to take it, you know, deal with it, so he ran his pickup truck into her car. Well, you know, let's back up, though, and really look at everything I just explained. And that this may mean nothing to people, that he was watching her with binoculars down the street and masturbating as she would drive by for months in the summer and earlier that fall. And then took his clothes off and ran in front of her car naked. And it might mean, they might say, well, why is that? You know, how does that show anything about his intent? If that's what they want to conclude, and that he was just getting back at her in a totally, you know, had nothing to do with sex or violence, they could conclude that. But they should read a little bit about sex and violence and how they work together. Or maybe they should consider the fact that he was talking about torturing women and raping and killing them while he was in prison when he got out, you know, for all those years. Maybe they should think through that and think if they really want to get solidly behind this guy and are absolutely convinced that he did not murder Teresa Halbach, maybe they should think about how is that for Teresa Halbach when he killed her in that way. If that's the way it happened, because we don't know for sure with Brendan Dassey, do we? But do we want to just conclude that that's all false, that he's the victim and Teresa Halbach is lost in all of this, you know, with everything this guy's about? Do we want to assume that the police are that they're making a murderer had it exactly right and that they were totally balanced and that the police clearly, obviously set him up again, and anybody that suggests otherwise, like me and others, is basically the enemy. You know?
Yeah. Well, you're the bad guy. Making a murderer has claimed that the prosecution didn't want to take part in it. Why do you think that was?
Well, I took part in it, but, and I understand what you're saying. You're talking about Kratz. I was in the first episode, mostly because I think of the first case. I wrote the book about Mr. Avery's first case where the police wrongly convicted him in a bad, bad, bad way, worse than most wrongful convictions. The Making a Murderer says that because I think they did probably ask the prosecution, and the prosecution, Kratz and whatever, probably said no. They may have thought there's some ethical issues in doing that while they're trying the case. Kratz didn't seem to be real shy about talking to the press, though. In my book, I refer to him as Ken, I never saw a camera I didn't like, Kratz. That was in the self-published version. I think one of the police officers, Link, actually did want, excuse me, Colburn, I believe, actually did want to talk to them, or at least did want to talk to the press since this. But County Corporation Counsel, the county's lawyer, I believe, anyhow, suggested that he didn't. You know, there's the cautiousness in government, too, that has not served them well. I suppose, I don't know that just saying that we asked them to and they wouldn't talk means that you can, that proves that you weren't, that you were objective in how you reported it. I mean, it just, people got to look at the entire thing and then decide, for instance, what I just talked about with the cat and the car, just as two examples, and the lack of any mention of his statement in prison that he's going to torture people when he's out and kill women and assault them and rape them. You know, that stuff's not in there. So does that mean they just left that out because the other side wouldn't talk to him, that, you know, too bad, we were being objective? I you know, again, people want to make that conclusion. They're welcome to it, but if they want to look at it objectively, I guess that's all I can say. I don't know what else to do other than to try to show that there might be another side to this. And
so what do you think? What do you think is next, really, for Steve Avery and the new lawyer?
Well, I think it's going to be fascinating. I mean, she is certainly an accomplished, talented, skilled attorney, and she has not been shy at all, though, you know, about what she thinks she can do and what she's done in the past. So everybody's got their different style, I guess. I imagine she'll be filing a motion for a new trial. I don't know when, and I imagine, you know, there'll be plenty of ammunition that she'll have to throw out there, and I guess we'll all wait to see what it is. I mean, I don't know. We got to be open to whatever she has. I think that's the way to do things. If she comes up with something that is absolutely surprising to me, you know, none of us have a corner on the, or a market or whatever it's called, a monopoly on the truth. So I don't believe there is anything, because I believe the evidence clearly, you know, not just beyond a reasonable doubt, that there's no question he did it. So I'd be shocked if she's got something that suggests he didn't. But then there's the question of did he get a fair trial, which is somewhat separate in a way. And I think legally that's an easy call as to Stephen Avery's case. I think he absolutely got a fair trial. I know your listeners who only watch Making Murder don't believe that. But, again...
Well, so do you think then... then if he was to take, if they would have tried this case in a different state where people were not personally involved, because it's not like it's not like a 5 million city, but if you would have taken it to another state and just on the evidence, and if they would have tried that case, do you think he still would have been found guilty, no problem?
Well, it wasn't no problem. The jury was out two and a half days, I think. So they chewed on it a long time and had to sort through a lot. And some of them, you know, probably weren't convinced until they thought through it completely and are probably still, you know, troubled by whether they did the right thing. That's not unusual. It's my understanding, he wanted his trial in Manitowoc County. They did not move for a change of venue, and a judge, I'm sure, would have granted a change of venue. You can't do it to a different state, but you could have done it to Milwaukee or the northwestern corner of the state, Superior, Duluth, or Superior is the one in Wisconsin, or the southwestern corner. I mean, you can get the case pretty far away. I think he thought Manitowoc County jurors, having heard about what the Manitowoc County police did last time, might be his best shot. Could you get a jury from another state? Not under the law in any state. I mean, there's been cases that had more publicity than this that, you know, that just doesn't work. And I don't think, you know, a fair trial requires that. People don't see how often the judge tells jurors, you know, you just because he's charged or just because of what you heard before doesn't mean he's guilty. You must not find him guilty. Right now he's presumed innocent until and unless the state overcomes the burden of proving he's guilty. I mean, it's said over and over, as it should be in a jury trial where you're looking at somebody's liberty, some states their life. Yeah, I do think he got a fair trial. I don't think the court is going to give him a new trial. I'm separating this out from Brendan Dassey. That one's pending right now, and more importantly, to some extent, Avery's is pending, although nothing's been filed by Ms. Elner yet. But I think factually and legally, the issues are so different among those two. And I think Brenda Dassey were just, you know, I'm not passing any judgment at all. And we'll see what the court does on Brenda Dassey's case.
Well, Michael Griesbach is the prosecuting attorney in the Wisconsin state where Steve Avery case happened. He's written The Innocent Killer. And I want people to remember to always treat people with respect. And when they listen and read, give their opinions, but be a little bit more human about it. Thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you, Al. Very much appreciate the chance to talk about the case with you.
Mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
This has been a production of the Z-Talk Radio Network.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.